My next guest is very creative. I just love this lady. We don't know each other that well, but we've chatted a few times before I invited her on the show. Dr. Judith Schlesinger. She spent her entire life, as it says here, marveling at creativity. And she's not only a psychotherapist and a psychologist, she's an author, educator, musician. She's a jazz critic and has me, as I am, a jazz nut and producer. And she's written a great book that I want to share with you, especially those of you guys who are like me, staying up late and digging music and creative arts. The Insanity Hoax, Exposing the Myth of the Mad Genius. Here's the, not to be confused with the mad genius, the beautiful genius, Judith Schlesinger. How do you like that intro, huh?
Wow. And you didn't even meet me and you know that.
That's I can incredible. Tell vibes, man. I can tell the vibes through the phone. Well, first of all, you and I share a love of music, and that's how we met, sort of. And then you told me about the work you do. And when I get into this, I realized right off the bat, this is perfect for the audience that we're talking to and about. So thank you. Let's talk about the title, The Insanity Hoax. What are we talking about here?
We're talking about a long-standing and perennial and evergreen and favorite myth that the more creative you are, the more likely you are to suffer some kind of mental disorder, that the two things go together. Nonsense.
No, and yet, as you point out so brilliantly, the media runs with these. I mean, we just had the death of the actor Philip Seymour Hoffman, a tragedy. But the media runs with these things, and you immediately say or hear, well, you know how it is with these artists, right?
Mm-hmm. I remember Amy Winehouse, Whitney Houston. I mean, it's very romantic, Jordan. Think about it. Think about the spectacle. It's a parade of dysfunctional genius, and it's just too romantic to give up. You know, and people just love it, the schadenfreude of it,
right.
You know, the joy in other people's misfortunes, particularly when those people have a talent you can't even touch.
Well, Judith, this, as you point out, this has a long history. It's not something that's 20th century or 21st century. It goes back to, decades and centuries ago. Tell us about the early days and what they were saying about the artistes back then.
Okay, well, we have to go all the way back to toga time. Which is where the roots of this thing are. And it started with Plato, as so many things do, who used the term divine madness to describe what happens when a poet gets inspired. And what that meant simply was that the god would visit him, the lesser gods, you know, the muses, and hang out for a bit and kind of shake him around until he created a poem, and then he'd disappear. The god would go away again, and the poem would be there. But somehow over the centuries, his use of the word madness meant inspiration.
Yes, yes.
But it has become clinical. See, for Plato, there was no ongoing character problem that created art. It was a temporary visitation, a very fortunate and longed-for visitation. Mm. But somehow that got darkened over the centuries into an ongoing character flaw of madness. That's not what he meant at all.
Right. Talking with Judith Schlesinger, PhD, author of The Insanity Hoax, Exposing the Myth of the Mad Genius. We have, of course, our old friend Sigmund Freud, who obviously was not hanging around any clubs, jazz clubs, and digging it. Boy, the way he really put a kibosh on a lot of this stuff, didn't he?
Well, not only that, but the poor man gave up sex at the age of 42, so I don't know why we even bother to listen to him.
I know. I saw that movie recently about Freud and Jung. It was actually a pretty good movie. And Freud just smoked a lot and was pretty boring. But here's the thing. The DSM, you know, that with the Bible, has this kind of stuff listed as a disorder in some cases.
Yes, yes. Well, it does. You know, we could do a whole other show on the DSM, which is a disgrace. And the new one that came out, if you had any idea of the backstage protests and screaming that went on to say, don't put this thing out, it's worse than ever. But I digress. The thing about the DSM is that the definition of a manic episode is almost exactly the definition of a creative episode.
You got a great chart in the book. I wanted to bring that up on page 50, which is truly worth looking at. Describe, if you will, what I'm talking about here.
Well, I actually, back to our common love of jazz, I framed the parallel within the context of a jazz musician who's making a new CD. Okay, if you've got an idea for a CD, you're going to be really excited about it. You're going to be talking about it. You're going to be forgetting to eat while you work on it. You'll be staying up late. You'll be neglecting your social responsibilities. Just to get this thing going, you'll have dreams that might not be realistic about it. Well, if you do all of those things, you're manic.
And then again,
definition.
And then again, if you do all of those things, you're Duke Ellington creating Black and Tan. I mean, you know, in a
yeah.
way, right? Now, here's something that you just mentioned, and you hit on this, of course, in a wonderful book, The Insanity Hoax, and that is the socialization issue, because so many people who are creative, and particularly writers and musicians, are alone when they're doing their thing. And when you go off like Walden, you become the weirdo.
Yeah.
Right?
But as you know, if you're trying to create, you don't need to be in the middle of a Honey Boo Boo episode. You know, you need
yeah.
quiet. You need to be to commune with your muse. You should excuse the expression. You know, you can't create in the middle of the Stop and Shop line. Although something might pop into your head, it's certainly not the place where you can really lay it out. So that's part of being creative. But, of course, if you want to pathologize it, you look at the isolation, you say, oh, my goodness, that person must be autistic, which is the diagnosis of the week. It's just maddening, Jordan, I'll tell you. It is.
Well, the word eccentric comes to mind. It drives me nuts when people and people are always doing this judgmentally. They're saying, well, that person is obviously, look at how he dresses, or look at the fact that he only drinks black coffee instead of lattes, whatever the hell it is. But eccentricity used to be, well, was it ever looked upon as something kind of cool? And then it kind of comes in and out of style, doesn't it, Judith?
I would say so. And there are two things I want to say about that. One is that there are people who, knowing that we believe that creative people are all nuts, act nutty to be thought of as creative. Steve Allen gave me this term. He called it the bohemian excuse. You know, you can't expect me to take out the garbage or remember when the rent is due. I'm an artiste.
Yeah.
You know, so that keeps the myth going as well. But as far as the eccentric and wacko and... You know, it's inherent in the beast. If you're going to be a creative person, you're going to color outside the lines.
And
if you're going to be a mad person, the same thing applies.
Right. It's interesting. I'm thinking of all the writers I've interviewed over the years, and I've done thousands of them, novelists and historians. And it's really interesting when you read a wacky, kooky, way-out novel, something by like Polachek or somebody like that, and you meet the guy. And oftentimes it's just a regular guy. But then you also meet people who label themselves as the creative muse of the world, and there's really nothing there except fluff.
It's all smoke and mirrors. Well, I think it was Anatole Breuillard. I think I put this quote in my book. He said, "There are just as many crazy and self-destructive bakers, but we do not analyze their cakes." And the point that I'm trying to make is I'm not saying that there are no creative people who have problems. I'm just saying there is no proof that creative people have any more problems than any other group. And there was a chance to do that statistically years ago when the government ran a study of 5,000 bipolar people, and they did not ask the question, are you creative? There was no place in the forum for people to say, I'm a freelancer or anything. There was just no room. 5,000 people, Jordan, that could have really settled it.
Now, I know that this is only one example, but you write in the early portion of the book about an experience you had with a young lady,
yeah.
I think at an institution, and what happens when she's very heavily medicated, but then she goes with you over to a room and sits down at the piano and something magical happens, but then she goes back into that state when the drugs kick in. I mean, it's not obviously universally this way, but tell us that story.
Okay, well, you've got it a little bit askew, but I'm glad that it was powerful enough to stick in your head.
Well, that's why you're here, to fix it. Go ahead.
Well, just lie down here and make yourself comfortable. No,
okay.
That's another thing. This young woman was, not that she was so heavily medicated and that changed her. What would happen was we would have these great conversations, and then all of a sudden a nurse would be looking for her to give her her midday dose, and she would transform like a reverse Hulk, kind of from this literate, articulate, funny, relational girl to a trembling, huddled mental patient. When the nurse came, handed her her meds, she was almost mute. You know, she took the meds, the nurse went away, and as soon as she was out of sight, she stood up straight and we resumed our conversation.
Okay, right, thank you. So it wasn't the meds themselves, but it was the oncoming nurse with...
And it was like my initial, I was young, early in my career, and I was completely baffled. I said, if this person has schizophrenia, where does it go? You know, how could she be both... And then she went in and played the Moonlight Sonata from memory. I mean, what's up with that? My supervisor had no answer for me.
It is so intriguing, the human mind and where it goes. I have a question for you, just a opinion here. When you look at someone like Orson Welles, the boy genius who did so much by the time he was 30 years old, in terms of film and what – and then he went on to become, you know, obviously a talk show guest a lot and an actor and so forth. But Orson Welles is –
Merchant.
Yeah, exactly. Drunken wine merchant. But Orson Welles is the guy that never could live up to the hype. And I know for a lot of creative people, that's a struggle, particularly in the public eye, where the – it's not them. I think it's just the public. Maybe Orson Welles said, I've got it. I did it. I'm moving on. J.D. Salinger type. What do you have to say about that kind of creative person?
Wow, that's an interesting point. And you brought me back to thinking of his voice, you know, and all the things, you know, we will sell no wine before the time kind of thing. Yeah, there is a lot of pressure, and I think this myth itself is all wrapped up with social expectations. You know that, and the prodigy thing is a very powerful influence on a lot of people. And I happen to know a child prodigy who was a monster on the piano by the time he was like 7, and he is the most well-adjusted, nice, respectful, responsible, loving kid you can imagine. I know somebody else who had the same early treatment, and you don't even want to be in the same room with this guy because he's such a putz. So what makes one person, you know, drink the Kool-Aid, drink the I am special and I must live up to it Kool-Aid, and somebody else say no thanks? You know, it's part of the intricacy of individuality. You can't have a hard and fast, you know, this is what it's going to do to you kind of thing.
But bottom line, and this is where your book makes the point over and over again, to label people who have great skill and are creative and write and create or perform in that, to just kind of label people in that particular neighborhood because they live there is just not thinking it through. It really isn't. Because I know people exactly like that who are brilliant at what they do, and they're just regular Joes and Janes, and they're great to be around. And then I know other people who are brilliant at what they do who are impossible. We all know that.
Well, that's sort of like your accountant or as Royard said, your baker. But it's not interesting to look at them. It's much more interesting to look at the artist who is flawed, because you look at him and you say, you know what, gee, I wish I could do what he does, but I'm so grateful I don't have his problem.
Well, we could spend another 4 years, you and I, just defining art and what it means to us and the aesthetic feeling we get. But I love this quote. You have a lot of great quotes to start each chapter, and I'll just read this one and we'll wrap with this. And it's by one of my favorite people. I actually met him when I was in high school. I was the guy who introduced him to my high school auditorium, Isaac Asimov. Inspect every piece of pseudoscience and you'll find a security blanket, a thumb to suck, a skirt to hold. What does the scientist have to offer in exchange? Uncertainty and insecurity. Cool.
Yeah.
Asimov was a guy with those sideburns and the bolo tie and 500 books that people thought was a whack job, and a brilliant guy.
He was clever. He was, you know, crazy like a fox, as they say. But if I could just make one more point, and this is what really drove me to write this book, which, by the way, is also funny. It's not a slog. You know, it's not a scientific slug.
I told people you were funny. I said that at the beginning. You're hysterical and very intriguing. I told you I loved you right off the start. Go ahead.
Well, thank you, but I can never hear it enough. You know how it goes. The thing that has really driven me to do 30 years of research and get this thing out when the publishers wouldn't do it because it wasn't sexy, because I wasn't like dissecting a famous person, was the fact that my fellow psychologists had been passing this garbage along for years without even reading a lot of the studies that all this is based on, which are garbage. And they pass this stuff along, and nobody thinks twice about it. And the public really deserves to know what the truth is, and they're not getting it.
Well, I think you've done a great job laying it out, even in a few minutes with me. But it's called The Insanity Hoax. That's also the website, theinsanityhoax.com. Judith Schlesinger is the author. The subtitle, Exposing the Myth of the Mad Genius. And I said this at the outset, there are so many people listening in this audience, my audience around the country, who are just so darn creative and wonderful. And it's nice to put one on their side for a change.
Yeah, you know? And all the wonderful people we're listening to. And how could they create all that beauty if they were completely disturbed? I mean, that's so demeaning.
Well, I agree, and I'm thankful for people like you. And great to have you on board, my dear. What a pleasure
to meet you, sir. Thanks so much.
You jazzed up our evening. The Insanity Hoax, Exposing the Myth of the Mad Genius by Judith Schlesinger. And go to theinsanityhoax.com. You will really find it entertaining and enlightening. And we'll be right back with more on The Jordan Rich Show.